and Miles, and this is Revolution Podcast. For the majority of you listening, happy Friday. Actually, it's getting about even now for the patrons and the other listeners. Patrons get this free, so this is a Thanksgiving morning if you're listening to this, or whatever you want to, I don't know what to call it. Thanksgiving seems kind of like a fucked up name for a weird fucked up holiday. But here in Mexico, we do not have the day off. It's not a big deal out here. Good to know. Of course it's not a big deal out here. That being said, this is the episode with Brenton Lingle. Gene had pitched this to us some time ago when we were trying to hurry up and fill out our end of the year calendar. He said, there's this guy that wrote a comic about the Spanish Civil War. We should get him on. You want to get him on? I was like, hell yeah. And I'm not going to lie, I don't know a lot about the Spanish Civil War. I have the book Spain in Our Hearts. I haven't gotten past the introduction. My daughter now has it, so there you go. Book thief. But I was not aware of the main character of Brenton's story. Buenaventura Durruti, famous, let's call him an anarchist or a libertarian socialist, but from early on, he was really rooted in working class politics, and we joked on the show, he's the first Avenger. He literally led a team of, I believe, anarchists called the Avengers and went to kill the king. He ended up killing a cardinal. This man is kind of a badass, and I understand, you know, why you would want to do a graphic novel about him. His life, his 40 years of life, are pretty action-packed, again, from a very young age. And it's going to be a series of books, so that's even more exciting. And also, Brenton works with friend of show, friend of also Give Them an Argument. He's the person that actually draws, probably does all of the artwork at this point for Ben, J. Andrew World. And J. Andrew World also is a contributor on Movie Night Extravaganza with producer Forrest. That show does air here. Also on the show, I did let the cat out of the bag. The Doug Lane will be giving us some content on This Is Revolution. He'll be airing some interviews here on this channel that he's doing. And he'll be airing his Critical Cuts videos on this channel as well. So I'm excited about that. For those that don't know, Doug was the first person to air This Is Revolution on his channel. And we were talking about it the other night, and jokingly he said, you know, I figured it'd be a good idea, you know, I like what you were doing, and I figured I'd play some episodes on the channel and it'd just be go viral. He goes, and it didn't. But nonetheless, we've stayed friends, and I guess you could say business associates. So when he came to me and said, hey, I want to air some stuff on your channel, it was like, yeah, fine. We'll just find a day and we'll air stuff then that day. It's not even a problem. So that's happening. Also, released a new album of instrumentals. So wherever you're listening to this show, there's links in the description. All this music that you hear is music that I put together. If it is mildly enjoyable to you, you can get it. The new volume of instrumentals that you usually hear in the clips, in the video essays. So because Doug took his channel down as well, we will be airing the video essays that we were doing for Zero Books on This Is Revolution, probably going up this week, as I am still stuck down here in Baja during the holiday season. I have a lot of time to do shit like that, like upload those goddamn videos. I need to stop cursing. Pascal's mom, Mama Robert, says I need to stop cursing. And you are right, Mama Robert. And happy birthday! Mama Robert turned 80 years old. So let's give it up for Mama Robert. Also, wherever you're listening to this show, there should be links in the description to Pascal's latest piece in Newsweek. Oh, yeah. Newsweek wanted to publish Pascal. There were some edits in it. They took out some things. He had his line, fat back and biscuits, and they took it out. So we're talking about maybe doing a video essay for the actual unedited piece. Let me know what you guys think. Drop some comments. You know what that music means. You listened to this for a while. I need to shut up now. Here is our interview with award-winning comic author and karate man, Brent Lingle. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This Is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles. If you haven't done it yet, please hit the like and subscribe buttons. Ring the bell. Get notified whenever we go live. We're going to be going live even more in the coming weeks because we're adding even more programming to the channel. Since Zero Books no longer has Doug Lane, he is moving some of his content over to this channel. Doug did help me out and Pascal out quite a bit early on by airing our show on the Zero channel. So of course, when he asked me if I could air his new Critical Cuts, I was like, yep. And then he said, can I air some videos on your channel? I was like, yep. Why not? Monday's open, and it does well on the audio only, so it should do well on live stream. So look forward to that. So again, that's why it's so important to hit that bell so you get notified. Also, you get notified when
my homie, my co-host, my dog, who you may know from being a writer in Newsweek now, Pascal Robert, does the Mau Mau, which is going to be going on tomorrow. So please welcome my co-host, my homie, my dog, the man of the Mau Mau Hour, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
Yes, Pascal Robert has a new piece out of Newsweek. We'll probably be talking about it a little bit in the bonus half. Have you got any comments, any responses, any weird new friend requests on social media?
No. I've generally got pretty supportive commentary. I mean, if you're familiar with the show and you're familiar with my writing, you're not unfamiliar with the analysis and the critique that I put in the piece. But I think that for those who are not exposed to a black left critique of the black political class, or that even creating that term, it's going to be a bit of a shock for them. So some people are like, oh, I can't believe they posted this in Newsweek. I'm getting a lot of that.
Tell me how you feel about this. You know, we were having our text conversation about the whole editing process that happens when you write for publications this large. I'm thinking, let's take the original content and let's make a video essay out of it.
We can do that.
Because there are some things that were left out that I think, you know, they edited out the catchphrase.
That's true.
And when you gave me that first draft, I was like, oh, they're definitely going to keep this catchphrase in there. And I guess it was too black for Newsweek.
I know, man. They took out some black quotes. From Newsweek. E. Franklin Frazier quotes, that Charles Johnson quotes. Those joints were gone. They kept the fire Adolph Reed quote, though. That was it.
But they didn't have Fatback and Biscuits. They did keep politics.
They took out the Fatback and Biscuits. And I thought they were going to keep that because they sent me back one revision with the Fatback and Biscuits.
I want you to read this comment on the screen.
Shout out to LME. Good to see you.
I'm waiting for Dr. Jason Johnson to provide a clap back on MSDNC over the coming weeks. I'm waiting for Glenn Lowry to clap back at Pascal, because there's one thing about Pascal a lot of the people that may watch the show don't know, is that Pascal is in the same universe as a lot of these people that he may critique, and he gets in these social media flame wars with them. So the fact that this piece is out, my first reaction was like, oh shit, now Pascal's got to go on John McWhorter and Glenn Lowry's show and we got to deal with that bullshit.
Oh, I don't have to do that at all, man.
It's black intellectual rap beef. That's all it is.
People who watch the show know that I judge people by their politics. I've said that before in the Mau Mau.
And those people have shit politics. We understand that. And they are going to come for you because you literally called them all out in that piece.
Oh, I didn't call anybody out by name. I was very, very amorphous kind of in the...
Tucker Carlson is not going to have Pascal on. He's going to think about it for 1 second, and then one of his producers is going to watch this show, and he's going to change his mind. Just for the fact that for like 2 weeks in a row, we played that Tucker Carlson and Umar Johnson thing, which is the funniest shit in the world. Well, let me shut up. We actually have a very interesting show.
I'm psyched.
Because... you were so quiet all day today, Pascal. I was nervous. I was like, is Pascal going to be ready for today? So I was like extra prepared because I was like, fuck, he's been too goddamn quiet. He hasn't hit me at one time to bitch at me about anything. He's too quiet. So now I know you're psyched. So now I can exhale a little bit more.
Today's my mother's birthday, man.
Oh, shit. That's how you celebrate birthdays in Haiti, right?
With gunfire. Yes, today's my mother's 80th birthday.
Oh my goodness. Happy birthday.
Yes. Oh,
Shout out to Pascal's mom, Mama Robert. Turns 80 today.
Yes, yes.
So hopefully let's make her proud today. So before we bring in our guest, let's play a little clip to get you guys ready for what we're going to talk about. Let's get back in the Wayback Machine to 1936.
The latter years of Spanish history have covered pages and chapters of unrelieved catastrophe. Riots, unrest, culminated in July 1936 in the unofficial commencement of civil war. General Franco marched on Madrid. His early successes on the way to the capital resulted in a stream of refugees seeking sanctuary in Gibraltar. From then till now, that stream of homeless human beings has never ceased.
In arrays, on rooftops and ledges of wall, the dying was repeated. The siege was broken, and it's said that loyalist blood ran out of the little plazas of execution, down the gutters, and into the river. The scars have not gone away. The Alcázar is being rebuilt over the years into a Civil War memorial, lest future generations forget. This generation will never forget.
The Spanish Civil War of the late 1930s was in many ways a dry run for the barbarities of the Second World War. The conflict pitted the forces of the Spanish Republic and their allies on the radical left against the nationalists and their fascist backers. One of the most significant figures on the left at the time was Buenaventura Durruti, a veteran revolutionary and leading libertarian socialist. As clashes between the nationalists and the Republicans heated up, Durruti led anarchists against military forces in the Barcelona region and, later, in the defense of Madrid, where he was killed in late 1936. We speak to Brenton Lingle, the author of a new graphic novel depicting Durruti's life, about who Durruti was, his historical significance, and how we might assess his legacy. This is Revolution.
Franco is dead. He died in bed. Nobody removed him from power. Nobody in Spain, be it the Democrats from the right or the left, were capable, able, willing, or courageous enough, and let's face it, courageous enough, to overthrow Franco and his dictator.
Thank you for watching.
Well, all right.
All right. Let's bring in our guest, who is coming from a bunker somewhere in North America. He's hiding. We can't say where. It's the kind of guest we have on this show. Please welcome. He is part karate ninja, part Neil Gaiman, part adventurer. He is artist and author, Brenton Lingle.
Hey guys, really happy to be here. And that, by the way, was the best intro anyone's ever given me. So thank you so much for that.
They don't read your bio. You know, I read the bio and I was like, is this a joke? And he's serious. And then there's the pictures of you doing the Appalachian Trail, which is with like 2,200 miles or something like that.
2,200 miles. Though when I did it, it was technically 1,186 miles or 2,186 miles.
It, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter. I ran 4 miles a day and everything hurts.
Yeah, I walked it And I'm also the author, actually, of the first play ever about that called North to Maine, which is sponsored by the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. Beyond that, I am the author of Snow White Zombie Apocalypse, the dark fantasy comic series, which is has been nominated for 2 Ringo Awards. And I am the author for this of Daruti, Shadow of the People. This, by the way, is not the comic. It's been sent to the printers. This is one of the 7 books that I read to actually be able to write this. This one is a biography by Abel Paz, who is also an anarchist and fought in the Spanish Civil War. He was 15 at the time, I believe. So I've been very lucky to have that biography through AK Press and the English translation by Chuck Morse, which was just... It couldn't have happened without it. So
what was very frustrating is that when I was trying to make that video, there are videos of Daruti, but they're all in Spanish. I was not prepared to try to listen to every word and try to translate it. If you guys saw, I'm living in Mexico, I don't speak Spanish, so if you saw the way I get around now, you would know this guy sucks. So what makes a karate comic man who's writing fantasy novels about Snow White and zombies want to take on, because from your video, and we will play your video, your trailer for your fundraising for your comic, which looks really, really interesting. I really love graphic novels. How do you go from kind of, I won't say silly, but darker fantasy stuff to taking on such a serious topic, also about a figure that no one really talks about when we talk about kind of important figures on the left, that actually he literally was an Avenger.
Yep. As in, he was the first Avenger because his anarchist group was called the Avengers.
So what were you doing when you said, stop everything that I'm doing? I want to write a graphic novel about this person because I want it to be accessible. I'm assuming that's why you wanted to be a graphic novel as well. It's also what you do. But accessible to everybody in the vein of Mouse or something like that.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, if you aren't super familiar with my work, it might be a bit of a surprise that I would go from something like Snow White Zombie Apocalypse, which is dark fantasy mixed with 70s kung fu and gender politics, to something very grounded in reality like Daruti. But the fact is that all of the art that I create is kind of a reflection of my life and my values and my headspace. And it's actually inherently tied into, my political journey that began, with hiking the Appalachian Trail, Maine to Georgia, and eventually led me to Occupy Wall Street, and then eventually to where I am today. Without giving you the whole David Copperfield thing, I was pretty much a normal American with normal American politics. But that started to fall apart when I hiked the Appalachian Trail, Maine to Georgia. And a lot of people don't know this about the AT, but the AT was actually designed and built by a socialist, Benton McKay. And the idea was for workers to get a chance to go out and interact with nature and, experience fellowship with the wilderness, because everybody was stuck in the cities and heavily alienated from this aspect. Now, that radical ideology has not remained with the trail culture, at least not nominally. But the thing is that, I lived for the 6 months that I was hiking from Maine to Georgia, or Georgia to Maine. I went northbound. I experienced a completely different way of life where, you bragged about how little you had. Your purpose was fulfilled every day because your purpose was just to walk, and it didn't matter how far you walked. You weren't in competition with anybody, just that you walked. And I met incredible people from all over the country and all walks of life, wonderful people who didn't fit in. And life took on this really incredible experience that I think it's kind of the closest that somebody can come to in the first world, you know, from like becoming a hunter-gatherer, essentially. It's a taste of kind of what we might have lived like before the rise of the state. And, you know, 20 miles out in the woods, there's no law, there's no police, but hey, we all actually take care of each other. And it's actually safer than, you know, it's definitely safer than Manhattan, you know, where I lived for 10 years afterwards. So that started to break things down in my head as I did it, because the whole community runs on stuff like random acts of kindness from strangers. Then moving to New York City and getting hit with, you know, just the huge cost of living, really seeing the class divide up close, and being an artist, I was running in circles with some of the, you know, some more proletarian folks, and also with some of the richest New Yorkers in the country. Richest people in the country, because there are a lot of them are in New York. And so like it, that really, I think, led to me seeing the world in a unique way, that a lot of people haven't had that ability to. It was also, you know, there was a bit of a shock to it. It was not entirely unlike, you know, waking up in a world surrounded by zombies that want to eat you and add your uniqueness to themselves. I think there's a bit of the shock of New York that made it into my themes with Snow White Zombie Apocalypse. But, you know, I would say just around like the winter of 2010, all of this was swirling around in my head. And I saw a graph that showed the distribution of wealth in the United States, where Americans think it is, where they want it to be, and where it actually is. And I just, looking at that, it blew my mind. I just sort of threw my hands up and said, you know, F it, property is theft. Shortly thereafter, Occupy Wall Street happened. And at first I dismissed it and was like, oh, you know, another socialist protest. They're not mad enough. I'll come back later. And then I started to see my friends there. And I started to see my friends getting arrested by the NYPD. And I was like, oh, I got to get down there. And around the same time, I was reading George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia and working as a playwright trying to get my name out there. Snow White Zombie started actually as a play. And after I found out about Buenaventura de Rudy, I, you know, really made a point to learn about his life so that I could write what was going to be a play. And then it wasn't really working as a play. It was a little more cinematic. So I wrote a screenplay, completed that. And then once I started finding that I was having a lot of success as a comic writer and creator, I was like, well, the next story I have to adapt after Swazza is Derudi, Shadow of the People. So really like the events of this graphic novel, this comic series, the first issue of which is about to come out, really chronicle a period in his life between his release from the French prison that he'd been thrown into for attempting to assassinate the Spanish king, to his death amid the rubble of Madrid. So it goes like prison to liberating an entire city from the scourge of fascism to leading an army of between 6,000 and 10,000 anarchists, 10,000 in the graphic novel, because that's the number you want to go for, to, yeah, this tragic and mysterious death amid the rubble of Madrid. And that's what people are going to get, you know, when they jump on with this series. So really, like, yeah, Swazza and that's what the cool kids call it, Snow White Zombie Apocalypse and Derudi are very different, but both of it is my writing, and it's dealing with the kinds of themes that I have really been interested in. I can't just create something to be commercial. Like it has to speak to something very, I guess, significant to myself. And, you know, when I discovered who Derudi was and what his life had been like, I was just like, oh my Lord, why don't I know about this guy? How, oh, right. I'm a writer. I can tell people about this guy. And, yeah, so far it's people are very excited, so I'm super happy about that.
Well, I appreciate you delving into the motivations that brought you here, but what I really wanted to tap into your knowledge base for, going into Derudi, can you give us the context of the Spanish Civil War? What was the actual realpolitik on the ground? Who were the actors? What was the motivating factor? What were the dialectics? Take us there, if you will.
Like leading up to, Pascal? You mean like leading up to the Spanish Civil War?
Leading up to, during the whole shebang.
Yeah, well, I can tell you sort of from the perspective of DeRudy's life, and also, you know, I first encountered the Spanish Civil War reading Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell, which is a phenomenal book. I highly recommend everyone read that. Like, even if you're not interested in the Spanish Civil War, if you're interested in the left and the problems that the left often faces, yeah, read that. Because, like, when I was at Occupy Wall Street, for instance, like, I would see stuff happening. I'm like, oh, it's... This happened in Homage to Catalonia, just with guns.
It's just funny, with a war. It's funny you say that. It's funny you say that because I don't know if a lot of people watching the show know this. A lot of Americans actually went to Spain to fight, and mm-hmm. Orwell was part of that cadre of Americans that went to fight. And Adam Hochschild, is that how you say his name? The guy that wrote
Hochschild.
Hochschild, yeah. The guy that wrote Leopold's Ghost. Wrote a book about the Americans that went over to fight.
In called Spain in Our... Well, he wrote a book called Spain in Our Hearts. Yeah, which was another one of the books I studied for this, by the way. That's a great historical book. I highly recommend that one. So the Orwell, of course, was British. But yeah, he came over a little bit before the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, or the Abraham Lincoln Battalion. He was part of this sort of international movement of people going there because Spain was the first time fascism had been stopped. So to give you kind of the, I guess, the cliff notes on, you know, the dialectics and the forces that were at play here, the Spanish Republic... it was really the Second Spanish Republic because essentially Spain was struggling with transitioning from monarchy to a liberal republic, through which they went through multiple dictatorships. And also there were very, very serious class politics within the United States, I'm sorry, within Spain at the time. One of the fascist generals during the Spanish Civil War was actually quoted as saying, like, do you know what's wrong with Spain? Indoor plumbing. Because in the past, we could have counted in spiritually better times, we could have counted on disease to wipe this vermin out. Since disease isn't doing it anymore, we have to do it ourselves, which is reported on in Spain in Our Hearts and a number of other historical accounts of the period. So there was a great deal of class hatred built up. And there was also an incredibly strong working class movement that was grounded in the peasantry and in peasant ideals and traditions, which is why the philosophy of Mikhail Bakunin, Peter Kropotkin, wound up taking root in Spain much more than, you know, like traditional Marxism, which was more industrial workers in the cities focused. Though obviously industrial workers really played into it. DeRudy himself was a mechanic and part of the metal workers union. So, I mean, DeRudy is born into a world on the brink of revolution in two world wars on the 14th of July, 1896. What he said, you know, as a child was, you know, the first thing I saw was suffering, not only in our family, but among our neighbors. Intuitively, I became a rebel. He grew up learning the principles of mechanics hand in hand with the tenets of revolutionary socialism in an apprentice to a radical blacksmith named Melchor Martinez. And at age 17, he joined the Metal Workers Union and soon was striking in solidarity with the celebrated and powerful Asturian miners. However, in 1917, during a nationwide general strike, the Spanish king, Alfonso XIII, ordered government troops to machine gun the Asturians and anyone else who stood in the way of getting the miners back to work. So facing government repression and military conscription, DeRudy, being that he had just seen the soldiers in the pay of the king, machine gun his friends, and he had received a draft notice that he was going to be drafted in that same military that just killed his friends. He said, the king will have one less soldier and one more revolutionary. Asturian miners smuggled him to France, and he began the life essentially as a professional militant and revolutionary. This period, what people really need to understand about, like, the Spanish Civil War, they'd already lived through one fascist dictatorship. This was also a time that the class war was very much not a cold war, but a hot war. I would compare it to, like, if Jeff Bezos was hiring assassins to murder people who talked about striking at Amazon to, like, pretend to be Amazon workers. And if, like, Elon Musk was hunting poor people for sport. Both of these, by the way, are real things that absolutely happened. It was called pistolerismoism and also reforma agraria. Where they would, the sons of wealthy landowners, I think during or even before the Civil War, would chase down peasants, murder them, dump them in a hole, and be like, you know, there's that patch of land that you always wanted, hence reforma agraria, agricultural reforms. So that's the world that Derruti is born into. And he spends a number of years kind of cutting a swath of revolutionary activity across five countries and two continents, Spain, France, very briefly in the United States, didn't do any revolutionary stuff here, but was in Cuba, Mexico, and Argentina as well. Then he robbed over a million, over half a million pesetas from the Bank of Spain, carried off out a bunch of radical expropriations. And then eventually when the Spanish king, the guy who had ordered his friends killed, you know, years and years before, was touring France, Derruti and several of his fellows, including Ascaso, his sort of right-hand man, conspired to attack and assassinate the king. They failed. The French police had infiltrated them, and they spent a month in jail. But the workers' movement was so strong at this time, and the Argentinian steamship that had been sent to get them, to take them back to Argentina to execute them, was late, and so Derruti was set free. Spent the next couple of years preparing. He met Nestor Makhno. If anybody's read Anarchy's Cossack, he's the other super important anarchist military leader. And they met, and, like, Nestor Makhno pledged to fight with him. That is happening in issue two, by the way. when Spain's military went fascist, Derruti returned to his native country. And the big thing that happened here, the big and incredible thing, was that the fascists completely dominated the south of Spain. But in the north, again, where anarchism had really taken root, union farmers, factory workers, you know, union people associated with the CNT-Phi, and Derruti, along with other forces like within Barcelona, stood up to, fought, and decisively defeated the fascist invasion, stopping their war machine dead in their tracks. And I mean, I don't think this is a feat that's ever actually been equaled militarily, to have a force of ordinary people defeat a modern, mechanized, professional army. And not simply defeat them or outlast them, but, like, they captured General Godard and executed him. So suddenly you had kind of the hope of the entire world. We'd seen fascism roll over one country after another, Germany and Italy being, you know, great examples. And there didn't seem to be any way to stop it at this point. And all of a sudden, boom, there it goes, stopped dead by this revolution. So folks really didn't know kind of what to do at the time. The liberals in Spain's government hated the anarchists, and this was both, you know, with the Caballero the Companies government and the Republican government, but they were allies. You also had it was less important at the beginning of the war, but there were a number of Marxists that fought. The PUM was a former Trotskyist, now kind of left Marxist unit that was the one that Orwell actually volunteered to serve in. And it's his account of fighting on the front lines with them that makes up the events of Homage to Catalonia. Essentially, you had three factions that had to unify to defeat the fascists, which were supported by the German Condor Legion and Mussolini's legionnaires who put in ground troops. So, you know, you had this sort of staging ground where you had the anarchists who had the revolution running, a ton of enthusiasm behind them, and the beginnings of a new world being built within the shell of the old, where they had overthrown these ways of organizing that people said were impossible. And not only had they done the impossible, but they had collectivized the entire city of Barcelona and the surrounding Aragon front, leading to a boom in agriculture. Since a lot of the land had been purposefully kept fallow by the Latifundians, which were a sort of feudal lords, essentially, the holdover feudal lords. That's why you get that Franco was fighting for a return of feudalism almost, as opposed to like modern fascism. You had the liberal Republicans that were trying to create, you know, a standard liberal Republican democratic government. And you had the Marxists, which were supported by Stalin and Comintern. You know, these three factions all hated each other. But they were all united to battle Franco. But ultimately, you know, the liberals preferred the other liberal nations, the United States and England preferred the fascists to the anarchists and even the liberals at this time. So no real aid came. The only aid that could possibly come at this point was given by Stalin. And also, by the way, hey, Mexico. Mexico really represented there. They battled for quite a while, but eventually were overwhelmed by the fascists after the Marxists suppressed the anarchists and the Trotskyists, reset the revolution in an anti-revolution sort of way by instituting private property, just, you know, kind of a liberal state under the control of Moscow, and then proceeded to lose the war to Franco, unfortunately. So, I mean, that's sort of, those were the political factions that were going on at the time. And that was kind of the struggle that was Spain, and the doom of them was the inability of the left to unite against the enemy of that was fascism.
Yeah, that's definitely a precursor to a current moment, if you could tell me, if we could say that. So what exactly was the driving force behind fascism in Spain?
I would say two things. I think fascism in Spain was driven by the monarchy. In the sense that, like, prior to the first, okay, so there was a fascist general, and there was a Spanish general that the king at the time, Alfonso the 13th, when it was looking like he was going to be forced out, essentially went to and said, hey, I want you to rule this country as a fascist general, and then you can let me come back and I'll just be the king and you can run things. And the guy was like, okay, yeah, sure. And as soon as the power was handed over to him, he, instead of ruling as a fascist general, set up elections. This was after the first fascist dictatorship, which was the dictatorship of Primo de Rivera. So this guy essentially allowed elections to happen, and the left coalition won those elections. And as a result, you had the founding of the Second Spanish Republic. So part of it was, I think, there was a feeling on the fascist end that their country was slipping from their grasp. There was also a kind of crazy hate that breeds when you see people that you think you're superior to beginning to gain power and to move towards equality and autonomy where they don't need you. In a lot of ways, also, it was colonialism rebounding on Spain, because a lot of the troops that would make up Franco's forces, these were people that had been sent to fight colonialist wars in Morocco. These were people who had been used, you know, essentially to enforce this kind of very brutal colonialist, structure abroad, coming home to Spain and just doing it to their own people, you know, who, again, they had, you know, ruled for, you know, centuries before this, and they'd ruled them with an iron fist. So I think there is a kind of crazy hate that just it makes some people snap. I think that was driving it. I think also there was, I think a lot of the forces particularly, you know, Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin knew they were all scrapping for a fight and a big war was coming, and they all wanted a proving ground to test their weapons. And that is exactly what Spain became for all of them, particularly for Hitler and Stalin. You know, like the famous painting of Guernica. Guernica was firebombed by the German Condor Legion, and the horrible reputation that Guernica had. I mean, like when Hitler went to meet with Austria to see about Austria rolling over to them, he brought the head of the Condor Legion, knowing that, you know, he had just massacred this Spanish village, and that there was a lot of terror associated with that. So I think, you know, as far as the Spanish Civil War goes, the fascists were being driven by that. They were being driven by a need to master their country and their fellow countrymen. And I think also it was just like the economic shutters of like a system like the Latifundian system that was quasi-feudal, kind of coming into contact with the modern world. There were huge, there's a propaganda film, one of the world's first, by wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, Ernest Hemingway, that he created to try to get American help for the Spanish Republic. And it centered around, it was called The Spanish Earth. And it centered around the fact that there were these large, large tracts of arable land. There was a food shortage. And the Latifundians, because they controlled it, were not allowing these lands to be farmed. You know, because why would they? you know, I think in a way it was just sort of the groans of, the world moving from a more backward feudal state into the early modern world.
Now, what the antagonism, was it ethnic, class, religious, a combination of all?
It was, I would say, class and religious. In fact, it's interesting. So if you read Spain in Our Hearts, he mentions actually at one point with the some black female nurses who came over from the United States witnessed like essentially the treatment of the Spanish peasantry and the proletariat by the upper class. And they essentially said they had never, ever seen anything like that, except like the racism that they had encountered. Like they said it was up to that level of abuse and hatred. You know, so it was essentially class-based. There may have been some ethnic issues as well. I'm not super well versed, because like there's a bunch of different peoples within Spain. You know, you've got the Basque, you've got the Catalans, who have always wanted to be to have their own country. You know, that's where Barcelona is. They've always kind of wanted to be independent from Spain. You've got religious persecution in the sense that, but even then, like the Catholic Church was mostly on the side of the fascists, but not entirely. And, you know, Franco, there were a number of leftists, priests and nuns that Franco murdered. So, and there were also like priests and nuns that fought as vicious fascists, like during this fight, because it was really like, you know, the Dali painting, like Spain's tearing itself apart. I think that, overall, there were definitely religious tensions. The Catholic Church was seen as an ally of fascism in a lot of places. Derruti was famously quoted as saying, you know, the only church that illuminates is a burning church, which he was quoting Peter Kropotkin with that. I would say, like, so, yeah, I think it was primarily class-based. There were probably some ethnic tensions coming into it, but ultimately it was class-based and somewhat a clash between, you know, Catholicism and anti-clericalism. Though it's also really important to know that, like, one of the sayings about like the Spanish and religion just that comes out of the country is they say the Spaniards follow their priests either with a candle or a club. So there's a reason why this is called like the Passionate War.
Wow. This is great stuff. So here's the question. What eventually leads to the death of Derruti, or the failure of the actual insurgents against the fascists?
Well, there were a couple things. So the biggest problem, I think, and I've gone over this time and time again, because everybody loves to, this is one of those what if moments, like, because if fascism had been defeated in Spain, there is a case you can make that the Second World War might not have happened or would not have been as devastating as it was, because it would have functioned as a major check on fascist growth and power. And, you know, who knows, maybe if, you know, Hitler and Mussolini get a black eye in Spain, maybe they're pushed out of power peacefully and we don't get the Holocaust. Well, we can't know about that. So I've thought about it and thought about it. I think the biggest problem for the Republic was that they seized all of the industry in the north. So the anarchists controlled a number of factories. They also controlled huge swaths, essentially the breadbasket of Spain. So they ate very, very well, particularly because they collectivized, and this led to a massive boom in food production. But they did not seize any war industry. Durruti himself, when he came to head the Durruti column, first marched on the city of Zaragoza, which had been like another kind of leftist anarchist stronghold that had been conquered by the fascists. Durruti was planning to assail Zaragoza with his anarchist troops and do essentially what they had done in Barcelona there. However, he was convinced by the Republican high command that this would be foolish and to wait, which I think was perhaps a very large mistake, though I can totally understand why anybody would do that. So they waited outside of Zaragoza for a while, preparing for a bigger attack with the forces with the combined forces of the Republic. But then Durruti wound up being asked to go to Madrid after taking the town of Caspe. So Durruti and his anarchists marched on Madrid, fought their first battle against Franco, won, and then Durruti was tragically killed, depending upon who you ask, either by a misfiring gun, a fascist sniper, or a Bolshevik assassin. Now, in my book, I leave it open, because that period in history is open. I know I have a personal point of view, and you will find it, like, if you read the book, you'll see kind of which one I think is most likely there, or at least the one that I think makes for the best story. I think if the anarchists had known that they would receive no help from the liberal governments, they weren't going to get any arms from England or Spain, they would have to rely almost entirely on Stalin, and Stalin did not arm them. He armed his people. The goal then should have been to march south and take the war industry in the south. If they were able to essentially push the revolution just pure adelante, they might have been able to sweep the country before Franco could really get his war machine running. And even with the help of the German Condor Legion and the Italian fascists, it is possible that they could have won the civil, like if they just gone all in. But I don't see anyone doing that, especially not someone newly into a position of power like the anarchists were, without like knowledge of the future, because conventional wisdom would be stop, wait, build up with your allies and march south when you're ready. But, you know, ultimately, I think the battle cry of Adelante forward was just a much better battle cry. I think encapsulates the best of the leftists within the Spanish Civil War, as opposed to the other major battle cry, which is no pasarán, they shall not pass, because they did.
Who did the United States support in the Spanish Civil War?
Officially, no one. The U.S. had a position of neutrality within it that was pushed by Roosevelt, supposedly for fear of angering Catholics, though I don't know how much of that was real. But also, and in fact, that was what the Spanish Earth was created by Ernest Hemingway to do, to try to get Roosevelt to support the Republic. However, privately, the U.S. supported the fascists in the sense that Shell and Texaco gave Franco essentially the world's first credit card and provided him with all of the oil that he needed to run his war machine free of charge with the knowledge that they would be paid back when he conquered the country. Now, this is really important because Franco didn't actually have the money that he needed to do this. They failed to capture Madrid, and Madrid, Spain at this time was one of the richest countries in the world. It had avoided World War I, had a huge store of gold, but no one would sell them the weapons. So officially the U.S. was neutral, but unofficially Franco was supported. Like, I know the head of Texaco was, after explicitly violating the law and giving Franco all the oil that he needed, he was called to Washington for a meeting, you know, bad boy, slap on the wrist, but absolutely nothing was done about it. And he continued to support Franco.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. So as, Jason, you want to
go? Yeah, I actually had a question that I've been waiting to ask towards the end of this, because I know it's probably going to be one of those questions that Pascal is going to want to jump in on as well. There was a popular front strategy that was used to elect a more leftist government. And as you kind of talked about, there definitely was squabbles amongst that leftist government. And as we mentioned, a popular front strategy, and I don't think the left is even strong enough right now. And I don't know how you feel about that, Brenton. We often say, Pascal often says on this show, the left in America and the States isn't strong enough to pop a grape. But
no, I agree. We can't even hold up our signs in a stiff breeze.
Well, I like that one. I like that one.
Damn. I got my mind around what I was going to say. Kind of fucked my head up with that one. I just see a bunch of mad dudes in hemp pants. Like,
hold on.
Was the popular front strategy a failure? And I'm asking this to both of you guys. Was it a failure? Or was the right just that strong?
Are you talking the popular front strategy as in the popular front strategy as in the
political strategy
or the military?
Say again. I didn't hear what you guys said.
You mean the electoral popular
electoral,
front or the military?
Electorally,
popular?
Electorally, yeah.
I mean, electorally, they won. They managed to win that election. This is like the important thing to understand about like fascists. The hard right in general, they are, can I swear on this?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're fuck ups. it's a total clown show every time these people do try to do anything. And you knew this, like if you read Homage to Catalonia, when Orwell attacks and like takes a fascist trench temporarily, like the people working with the fascists were mostly at the time were mostly conscripts. You know, and there wasn't a lot of loyalty there, and they didn't really have there's this idea of fascists because of our movies as like these like hyper competent, almost mechanistic force. But no, like, I mean, Franco, they mentioned Franco died in his bed. Yeah, he died in his bed clutching the severed hand of Saint Teresa de Avila, supposedly. Like, he carried that thing, the jeweled reliquary of her hand, everywhere with him. Like, it was a freaking nuclear football. So, supposedly slept with it under his pillow, you know, died clutching it. And he was a guy who was deeply paranoid, with a ton of crazy conspiracy theories. They were not particularly well organized, and even with the support of the Condor Legion and Mussolini's legionnaires, like if there had been a unified military response, if the anarchists had been given weapons in much the same way that like the United States, we armed the PKK YPG before Trump betrayed them. And they wound up, even before we armed them, being the best fighters against ISIS. The anarchist militias were the absolute best fighters against the fascists. The problem was They didn't have any tanks. They didn't have any cannons. They didn't have any artillery or airplanes. And what, ironically, you know, I think that the problem being that the ideology was seen as so radical at the time that, you know, liberals either sat it out or, you know, tacitly supported the fascists. So I guess it's kind of a lesson in the inherent tragedy of being ahead of your time, even when you are proving that this method of organizing actually works and gets incredible results in one of the most difficult environments to prove that. So I think the Popular Front strategy failed because, so first, the anarchists won the war, the anarchists won in the North and held the line. However, they didn't have the military technology that they needed. They didn't have large nations supporting them. So then you had Stalin come in, Stalin being the only person who would give the Republic any kind of weapons. And by the way, he did it in exchange for almost all the gold in the Bank of Spain. You know, once you had the Russians arrive, you know, the communists began to gain power over the anarchists and used that power to suppress the anarchists rather than form a united front. Once the anarchists were suppressed after the May Day fighting, what wound up happening was that it was like you had hobbled the revolution, because what were people fighting for anymore? You know, the communists reinstituted private property, gave, you know, and as soon as they did, suddenly there were shortages. Suddenly there were people who were less willing to go and to the front and die and fight for something. Because what are you fighting for? You're fighting for more of the same. And, you know, ironically, I might even compare that as a super heightened version of what happened when, like, Hillary squeezed out Bernie in 2016. There's a ton of enthusiasm. And then once it went away, you know, you've got a choice between a bunch of people have someone that they really, really like, who is horrifically evil, Donald Trump, and somebody that pretty much no one likes, but just isn't that person. And obviously the positive force in that case being the force of Trumpism, fascism, whatever, is going to roll over the force of people just simply trying to resist it. So I think that it was by killing the revolution, they essentially doomed the war effort, and that doomed the Popular Front, because what they needed was they needed people who were excited and driven and willing to stand up to fascism. And once they gave them nothing to fight for, only something to fight against, you're just going to lose.
I do like that statement, nothing to fight for, only something to fight against, because I think that's one of the issues that we have right now. I do want to address a super chat question before we get out of here in the hour. This is from JB. He asks, Brenton, in your estimation, what is unique about Catalonia and Catalan politics and makes it conducive to leftist politics in the context of independence?
Well, I mean, I think first off, the you know, the Catalans have a long history of wanting independence from Spain. I think also, you know, you're getting close to the Pyrenees mountains. Mountain folk are hard to control. We always have been. And I think that that region in Spain has just always been, it had the right combination of workers' power. It had the right combination of ideology and the right combination of resources and terrain to essentially be the cradle from which it seemed that the revolution would be born. And, you know, there's another universe out there, I think, where it was. And, you know, maybe not all of Spain, but Catalonia, you know, became the world's first anarchist country, if you can call it that. And I'd be very interested to see that universe and to see what happened from there. Because there is a part of me that thinks that if, you know, the revolution had not been strangled in its cradle, like, you're never getting the genie back in the bottle after that. especially when you prove that you can do it without a, you know, hugely oppressive totalitarian regime building socialism for you, but just ordinary people doing it themselves, you know, spontaneously. So, yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, also, I think there's something about the Spanish character. Orwell talked about it towards the end when if you've only read 1984, like 1984 could not have been written without Homage to Catalonia, because Orwell experienced the events that would go on to inspire a lot in 1984, you know, being part of the PUM, which, you know, was declared a secret fascist organization by the Stalinists. And, you know, he had to flee Spain, you know, after, you know, fighting fascists on the line, after being shot through the neck by a fascist and recovering, you know, only to be told, oh, you were actually a secret fascist the whole time. But he noted, like, sort of the way that even when, like, the secret police, the Spanish secret police that had been, you know, trained by the Russians, like, showed up at his hotel room and tore the hotel room apart trying to find contraband and all that stuff, there was a level of propriety that, like, the police were embarrassed to raid, like, the bed of a woman because his wife was with him. And he said he doesn't think that totalitarianism of any kind will take root in Spain for long, be it, you know, the Stalinist kind or the fascist kind. And we saw that, you know. They had the Franco government, and after Franco died, you know, they transitioned to a liberal republic again. So I think there is an inherently passionate and anti-authoritarian strain to the Spanish character, and especially to the Catalans.
Well, Franco was in power for a long time before he died.
The original clip was a lot longer, and there was the UK has some actually really good footage. And there was some footage of a documentary that was done in 69, and it was Spain in 69. And for those of you that don't know, the government ran the trade unions. And that was one of the things that, you know, people like Derruti were against, right? The government running the trade unions, and also private, the owners of business ran trade unions.
Yeah, so that was what the Pistolerismo came from. Those were yellow unions. So as I talked earlier, because, you know, the revolutionary situation there was, you know, so crazy. Yeah, like, there were yellow unions that were set up by the company that you were required to join. And these unions were filled not just with fellow workers, but with pistolerismos, with assassins hired to pretend to be workers. And if they heard someone talking about striking or organizing, they take them out back, they shoot them in the head. You know, again,
people in the documentary were disappearing and getting put in prison for organizing strikes. Religious figures were trying to organize. And I guess this was a time where a lot of priests were not in the churches. They were actually working in factories to kind of protest what was going on. There was clips that were originally going to be in that, but I was like, let's just keep it Spanish Civil War. But
as I said, the church's position, you know, history has seen the Catholic Church's position as pro-fascist. And that's sort of where the propaganda goes, because a lot is made of, like, red terrors where, you know, bad things happen to priests and nuns and, like, you know, churches got burned and looted. But again, it was a much more complicated situation. And, you know, there, I think the Catholic Church in general, you know, you've got the hardliners and you've got liberation theology. So I want to make it clear. Yeah, there were a lot of priests and monks and nuns that were very much on the side of the common man and very much on the side of the revolution. And, you know, from what I can tell, you know, these were not the people that were targeted when there were, you know, red terrors and reprisal killings and that kind of thing.
Well, we are coming up on an hour. Brenton, will you be able to join us for the bonus? Do you have any more time?
Definitely. I'm having a blast.
Oh, fuck yeah. Because Pascal didn't even get into all his fucking anarchist questions that he wants to ask.
That'll be fun. I'd love to talk about those.
Well, wherever you're listening to the show or watching the show, I put up links in the chat for Brenton's Kickstarter and also for his YouTube. Please go subscribe to his YouTube. Let's actually go out. We always go out with some go out music. Here, Pascal, say something profound while I find this clip.
This was a very, very educational program. I really like you putting the Spanish Civil War in its kind of context in terms of the factions of Britain. That was very good. And I appreciate you kind of explaining the role of, you know, there are a lot of Marxist-Leninists who are like, anarchists, show us your wins. It's a very common thing you hear on the left. But I've always been aware of the role of the anarchists in the Spanish Civil War. And actually, I do consider it a victory on their part, even though they were not able to neutralize Franco completely. And Catalonia, to me, is definitely something that looks like, you know, where they tried to make it happen. But the anarchists who know that history will always remind the Marxist-Leninists or the communists about that, as well as a lot of other things as well. But on This Is Revolution podcast, we believe in non-sectarian leftism. So
as do I should add, I had some, you know, criticism for the Stalinists at the time, but, you know, I got a lot of, committed Marxist comrades, and I think it's very important that we do be non-sectarian moving forward.
Yeah. Particularly since we're at a stage where the left doesn't have the power to pop a grape, which is the situation we're in right now. But,
Jason, well, I'm having all kinds of issues with my very slow Baja California connection right now. I think I found it. Keep talking.
All right. No. Well, I'll say to folks, if you guys are curious, yeah, you can search, go to Kickstarter, search Durruti, D-U-R-R-U-T-I. It's Durruti, Shadow of the People. It's put out by my company, Autonomous Collective. We are funded, which was really, really great. AK Press came on to support us. J. Andrew World has been a huge champion of the comic, and also did a poster and print for us. Oh, you bringing that up? And
I finally got it. J. Andrew World is also a friend of this show as well.
Yeah, phenomenal guy. Great artist, too. So I did want to give him a shout out. You can also, if you click pre-order, you can pre-order the first issue of the comic, get in on this on the ground floor, where there's a film in the works that I'm working with Enon Films about it. And also, if you follow, you can get cool stuff like this Durruti column patch that we had custom created, and also this Durruti coin, which is a gear, has Buena Ventura Durruti, the years he lived, and on the back it has his the anarchist symbol and his famous slogan saying, which is the in English, each of us carries a new world in our hearts.
If you're a patron, stay tuned for the patron bonus half, where we're going to go deeper. I do want to read, there's a great Durruti quote that I actually saved. Is we the workers who build these palaces and cities here in Spain and in America and everywhere, we the workers, we can build others to take their place and better ones. We are not in the least afraid of ruins. We are going to inherit the earth. There is not the slightest doubt about that. The bourgeoisie might blast and ruin its own world before it leaves the stage of history. We carry a new world here in our hearts.
That world is growing
in this minute.
In this minute. Adelante.
That's from Buena Ventura Durruti. That is a wonderful quote. And we are going to leave by playing Brenton's trailer.
Tormentas agitan los aires, nubes oscuras nos impiden. nos espera el dolor y la muerte. Contra el enemigo nos llama al deber. El bien más preciado es la libertad. Hay que defenderla con fe. Nos llevan pues, alza la bandera revolucionaria, que del triunfo sin cesar nos llevan pues, en pie pues.